I now give the floor to Mr. George Samueli.
Thank you, Madam President, and thank you for giving me this opportunity to address this distinguished body. If ever a war could easily have been avoided, the war in Ukraine is that war. If ever a war was needlessly provoked, the war in Ukraine is that war. The war in Ukraine came about as a result of the Western powers' single-minded insistence of scooping up every single country on the European continent into NATO and on expanding the borders of NATO right up to the borders of the Russian Federation. The war in Ukraine came about because the Western powers, for more than three decades, continued to dismiss the innumerable pleas of successive Soviet and Russian leaders, including Mikhail Gorbachev, Boris Yeltsin, and Vladimir Putin, that there can be no security for anyone unless the West and Russia agree on a common framework for peace that guarantees the freedom and security for all. How do we know this? Because former NATO Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg told us as much. In September 2023, Stoltenberg went before the European Parliament's Foreign Affairs Committee and explained very succinctly that the war in Ukraine could have been avoided had NATO not insisted on moving its military infrastructure up to Russia's borders. President Putin, he explained, had, quote, actually sent a draft treaty that they wanted NATO to sign, to promise no more NATO enlargement. He wanted us to sign that promise never to enlarge NATO. We rejected that, so he went to war to prevent NATO, more NATO, close to his borders. He got the exact opposite. What Stoltenberg was referring to here were the two draft proposals for a new security architecture for Europe that Russia had issued on December the 17th, 2021. The proposals, one addressed to NATO, one addressed to the United States, recalled the framework of the Helsinki Final Act of 1975, in which the mutually antagonistic parties of the Cold War agreed to recognize one another's security concerns and pledged not to enhance their own security at the expense of that of their purported adversaries. At the heart of Russia's proposals was a commitment by NATO to no further expansion, and in particular, to no NATO membership for Ukraine. There was nothing so extraordinary about that. In its 1990 Declaration of State Sovereignty, Ukraine had declared, quote, its intention of becoming a permanently neutral state that does not participate in military blocs. The notion propagated by NATO spokesmen and Western policymakers that every state has the sovereign right to join any military alliance it wants, to deploy whatever armaments it wants on its territory, and to ignore the security concerns of its neighbors, flies in the face of innumerable international treaties and covenants, not to mention the international practice of states since time immemorial. The Helsinki Final Act of 1975 spoke of the indivisibility of security. The 1990 Charter of Paris for a New Europe declared security is indivisible and the security of every participating state is inseparably linked to that of all the others. The OSCE's 1999 Istanbul document repeatedly returns to the theme of what it called, quote, the concept of common, comprehensive, and indivisible security, and a common security space free of dividing lines. And let's not forget, of course, that in October 1962, the United States did not accept the argument that the island of Cuba had the sovereign right to station on its territory whatever weapon systems it felt it needed for its security. However, the security the Western powers demand for themselves, they refuse to extend to others, particularly to the Russian Federation. The Cold War came to an end in 1991. The Soviet Union dissolved the Warsaw Pact, then dissolved itself, then abandoned the communist ideology that had once generated so much fear and suspicion in the West. Russia wanted nothing more than to be left in peace to rebuild its shattered economy. Recall Russian President Boris Yeltsin's words before the joint session of the U.S. Congress on June the 17th, 1992. Quote, today the freedom of America is being upheld in Russia. The idol of communism, which spread everywhere social strife, animosity, and unparalleled brutality, has collapsed. It has collapsed, never to rise again. I am here to assure you we will not let it rise again in our land. What had taken place at that time was unprecedented in human history. Soviet and Russian leaders gave up territory, gave up military allies, and sacrificed security. Recall, They did not have to do this. The Soviet Union had lost no war. To the contrary, the Soviet Union was still a formidable military and political force, inspiring fear and respect throughout the world. Soviet and Russian leaders did what they did because they believed it to be the right thing to do. Yet Western leaders interpreted the end of the Cold War as a victory for the West and a humiliating defeat for the Soviet Union. According to former President George H.W. Bush, the Soviet Union did not simply lose the Cold War, the Western democracies won it. And as the supposed victors, the Western powers immediately set about scooping up their winnings. They proceeded to contain, surround, and encircle Russia so that Russia would never again be a great power. Most shocking of all, especially to the Russians, was the speed with which the West did all of this. Let's recall U.S. Secretary of State James Baker's words to Mikhail Gorbachev in Moscow on February the 9th, 1990. The Berlin Wall had fallen only 3 months earlier, yet the United States was already pushing for a united Germany inside NATO. To get Gorbachev to agree to this, Baker pledged that NATO would not move, quote, one inch to the east. Subsequently, Western politicians claimed that Baker was referring only to the territory of East Germany, not to the countries of Eastern Europe. But this is a thoroughly disingenuous claim. At the time of Baker's meeting with Gorbachev, the Warsaw Pact was still in existence. And since the countries of the Warsaw Pact were all to the east of Germany, the words, not one inch to the east, would have had to be referring to them. From that moment, in February 1990, Western leaders were to give Russian leaders repeated assurances that there would be no NATO expansion, only to walk back those assurances the moment they had secured whatever concessions they were seeking from Moscow. Former UK Prime Minister John Major, for example, declared in March 1991 that he, quote, does not foresee conditions currently or in the future under which East European countries could be in NATO. Then there was former NATO Secretary General Manfred Werner, who, after having assured a visiting Russian delegation that neither he nor anyone else in NATO was interested in NATO enlargement, was by March 1993 pressing then US Secretary of State Warren Christopher to, quote, start considering possible timeframes, candidates and criteria for membership expansion. Madam President, esteemed representatives, once the Western powers embarked on NATO expansion, things moved with extraordinary speed. All that was needed was to tell the Russians that what was actually happening wasn't really happening, that it was all a figment of their imagination. For example, President Bill Clinton, after assuring President Yeltsin that the Partnership for Peace program was an alternative to NATO enlargement and not a preliminary step towards it, immediately went back on his word. In January 1994, in Prague, Clinton declared that, yes, Partnership for Peace was indeed the first step towards NATO membership. Partnership for Peace, he said, quote, is not a permanent holding room. It changes the entire NATO dialogue so that now the question is no longer whether NATO will take on new members, but when and how. Moreover, even at that early moment, Clinton was already indicating that the eventual goal was Ukraine's induction into NATO. In a July 1995 memo written for President Clinton, then National Security Advisor Anthony Lake boasted that the US intended to ride roughshod over the qualms of some Europeans that NATO enlargement was moving too quickly. Lake boasted, quote, some allies reacted to Russian criticisms of enlargement by suggesting that the alliance slow the process. We successfully insisted NATO stick to the timetable. Yet in public, US and NATO leaders were saying something different, something that was manifestly untrue, namely that NATO expansion was all about ending divisions and bringing stability to Europe. For example, in 1994, Secretary of State Warren Christopher declared, quote, the expansion of NATO will advance America's fundamental goal, a peaceful, undivided, and democratic Europe. NATO enlargement will enhance stability, reduce tensions, and prevent new dividing lines in Europe. U.S. Secretary of State Madeleine Albright proclaimed in February 1997, quote, NATO has helped bring within our grasp the most elusive dream of this century, an undivided Europe at peace in which every nation is free and every free nation is a partner. For those not invited to join this year, but who wish to join, NATO's door must remain open. But how could there be stability? How could there be no new dividing lines in Europe if NATO expansion was to be directed toward exclusion of Russia. Russian leaders repeatedly expressed an interest in NATO membership. In a December 1991 letter to NATO leaders, written shortly after the Soviet Union's dissolution, Boris Yeltsin proposed exploring a framework for Russia's possible membership in NATO. In 1993, in conversations with US and European leaders, Yeltsin again raised the possibility of Russia's joining NATO. Yeltsin told NATO Secretary General Manfred Werner that Russia might consider NATO membership if the alliance were to become a political organization rather than a military one. President Putin also spoke of Russia's interest in NATO membership. In March 2000, asked by BBC presenter Sir David Frost whether Russia could possibly join NATO, Putin replied, "I don't see why not. I would not rule out such a possibility if and when Russia's views are taken into account as those of an equal partner." Putin discussed possible NATO membership with President Clinton. Clinton reportedly responded, "I have no objection." Later on, Clinton told him, "You know, I've talked to my team. No, it's not possible now." NATO leaders showed not the slightest interest in exploring these offers of genuine partnership, genuine dissolution of barriers, and genuine frameworks for mutual security. That NATO expansion directed towards the exclusion of Russia, towards the containment and encirclement of Russia, would end in disaster was obvious to seasoned observers of international affairs. Renowned diplomat and historian George F. Kennan expressed his disgust at this mad rush towards NATO enlargement. "I think it's the beginning of a new Cold War," he warned in 1998. "I think the Russians will gradually react quite adversely and it will affect their policies. I think it is a tragic mistake. There was no reason for this whatsoever. No one was threatening anybody else." An obvious question arises. What was behind this rush for NATO enlargement? What was the need for it? No one was threatening anybody else. To the contrary, relations between Russia and the West were unprecedented in their conviviality. Yeltsin cooperated with NATO and Yugoslavia, even working against the interests of Russia's traditional ally, the Serbs. This cooperation continued with Putin. Putin was the first foreign leader to call President Bush after the 9/11 terrorist attacks and proclaimed that Russia would become America's partner in the global war on terror. Putin permitted the United States to transit troops and weapons across Russian territory en route to Afghanistan. President Clinton has explained the rationale behind his push to expand NATO. Writing in an April 2022 edition of The Atlantic, Clinton explained that it was all about his fear of Russia's supposed, quote, return to ultranationalism, replacing democracy and cooperation with aspirations to empire like Peter the Great and Catherine the Great. If Russia chose to revert to ultranationalist imperialism, fueled by natural resources and characterized by a strong authoritarian government with a powerful military, an enlarged NATO and a growing European Union would bolster the continent's security. So there we have it. Nothing here about ending divisions in Europe, about extending security throughout the European continent, and all those other grandiose declarations NATO leaders have regaled us with for the past three decades. It was all, as Russian leaders had suspected, all about containing and encircling Russia with a hostile military alliance. Madam President, esteemed representatives, over the years, Russian leaders have made their feelings plain, but their protests were repeatedly dismissed and ignored. In an interview with The Telegraph in 2008, former Soviet President Gorbachev said, quote, "The Americans promised that NATO wouldn't move beyond the boundaries of Germany after the Cold War, but now half of Central and Eastern Europe are members. So what happened to their promises?" President Yeltsin repeatedly expressed bafflement as to why NATO was expanding at breakneck speed to the east if NATO and Russia were supposed to be partners. In a November 1994 letter to Clinton, Yeltsin warned that the Russian people were increasingly seeing NATO expansion as, quote, the beginning of a new split in Europe. In December 1994, Yeltsin asked, quote, "Why sow the seeds of mistrust? After all, we are no longer enemies." In May 1995, in a one-on-one conversation at the Kremlin with Clinton, Yeltsin declared, "I see nothing but humiliation for Russia if you proceed. How do you think it looks to us if one bloc continues to exist while the Warsaw Pact has been abolished?" It's a new form of encirclement if the once surviving Cold War bloc expands right up to the borders of Russia. Moreover, Russian leaders were only too aware that NATO had long set its sights on eventual Ukraine membership. In March 1997, in Helsinki, Clinton disclosed to Yeltsin that, yes, the former republics of the USSR would indeed be joining NATO, and that that would, of course, include Ukraine. From that moment, things move quickly. May 1997 sees the opening of the official NATO Information and Documentation Center in Kiev. July 1997 sees the signing of a NATO-Ukraine charter and the establishment of a NATO-Ukraine commission. November 2002 sees the NATO-Ukraine action plan. In April 2005, President George W. Bush and then Ukraine President Viktor Yushchenko jointly declare, quote, "The United States supports NATO, Ukraine's NATO aspirations and is prepared to help Ukraine achieve its goals. The United States supports an offer of an intensified dialogue on membership issues with Ukraine." April 2008, of course, sees the NATO announcement in Bucharest that Ukraine would be a member of NATO. And then, just to take matters up to the present day, we have U.S. Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin announce in October 2021 that the door to NATO membership for Ukraine was open. As to how the Russians were likely to view Ukraine's membership of NATO, there is no better source for this than the current CIA director, William Burns. In 2008, as U.S. ambassador to Moscow, Burns wrote an email to U.S. Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice in which he explained, quote, "Ukrainian entry into NATO is the brightest of all red lines for the Russian elite. In more than 2.5 years of conversations with key Russian players, from knuckle draggers in the dark recesses of the Kremlin to Putin's sharpest liberal critics, I have yet to find anyone who views Ukraine in NATO as anything other than a direct challenge to Russia's interests." Madam President, esteemed representatives, that the current war in Ukraine was always about NATO expansion and not about seizure of territory was obvious from the arc of the peace negotiations that took place shortly after the start of the conflict, first in Minsk, then in Istanbul. In April 2022, in Istanbul, Russia and Ukraine reached and initialed an agreement, the most important part of which was that Ukraine would pledge to become a permanently neutral state. It would never join NATO or allow foreign military bases and contingents on its soil. Ukraine could, however, seek membership of the European Union. Crucially, however, Ukraine was not asked to forego its sovereign claims over Crimea, Donetsk, and Lugansk. Those matters were to be resolved in future discussions between the presidents of Russia and Ukraine. However, this eminently reasonable agreement that would have brought the war to an immediate end was not to the liking of key NATO leaders. Washington became alarmed that Ukraine was about to agree to this deal. According to the New York Times, U.S. officials told their Ukrainian counterparts, quote, "You understand this is unilateral disarmament, right?" Finally, UK Prime Minister Boris Johnson flew to Kiev and urged Zelensky to drop the idea. "Putin was a war criminal," Johnson said. "He should be crushed, not negotiated with." Even if Ukraine were ready to sign a deal, Johnson told him, the NATO powers were not. Following the collapse of the talks, Turkey's foreign minister declared, quote, "There are those within the NATO member states that want the war to continue and Russia to get weaker." NATO's policy thus remains unchanged. Despite everything that has happened, despite the experience of the past 30 years, despite the obvious fact that the expansion up to Russia's borders has generated instability and war, despite all of that, what does NATO do? It continues to insist that Ukraine must and will be a member of NATO. In other words, the war must go on for the sake of a cause, Ukraine's membership of NATO, that guarantees war. NATO's leaders are like the Bourbons. They have learned nothing and forgotten nothing. Thank you very much for your time and attention.
I now give the floor to members of the Council who would like to make a statement. I give the floor to the representative of the Russian Federation.
Madam President, we'd like to thank the representative of European civil society, George Samueli, for his sobering report about what's actually happening and what triggered the current conflict, a conflict that's not pitting Ukraine against Russia, but Russia and the West, that is Russia and the US and NATO. We can add to his report something that was uttered yesterday by the Slovakian Prime Minister, Robert Fico. In Europe, we no longer use the word peace. That word doesn't exist. Anyone who speaks of peace is seen as fueling war. Anyone who speaks of war is deemed to be fighting for peace. End of quote. This is the Orwellian reality in which Western states reside in today. They've decided to use the hands of the Kiev regime to inflict strategic defeat on Russia. But their plans are a fiasco. The head of the Kiev junta is concerned. He's concerned that him and his posse are going to be thrown under the bus, to put it simply. He's even blackmailing the world by saying that Ukraine might get a nuclear weapon. This is something we discussed in detail on the 21st of October. Yet our Western colleagues didn't say a word about that. Or sometimes the Kiev junta is getting involved in military escapades, for instance, the one in the Kursk region, where the Ukrainian army suffered losses of over 25,000 people, including its best trained reserves. There are no effective plans B, C, or otherwise, which could be used to change the catastrophic situation for the Ukrainian army. Neither Kiev, nor Washington, nor London, nor Brussels have such a plan, nor can they come up with one. It's clear that without the West's direct involvement in the war with a nuclear power, something that the past Ukrainian president ardently wants, the Ukrainian military will continue to retreat and sustain catastrophic losses. This is unequivocally supported by information from the front, where the Russian army is successfully and gradually leading its offensive campaign against key areas. This is something that cannot be denied even by Western military experts. According to their data, in October alone, we liberated 478 square kilometers in October alone. By the end of the month, this was happening at a pace of 30 square kilometers a day. The Russian military, in just the last few days, liberated such large and strategically important settlements such as Gornyak, Selidova, Katerinovka, Dobrovolya, Bogoyevlenka, Izmailovka, Alexandropol, Shakhtyorskaya, and Vishnyovaya. The counteroffensive that Ukraine led in 2023. And during that campaign, it got just 250 square kilometers, which we've since then liberated. So in 2023, as a whole, it seized two times less territory than we've managed to liberate per month. The Kyiv authorities are working very hard to hide the truth from their people and their Western sponsors. As we learned yesterday, Ukrainian servicemen were ordered to use in their discussions with journalists the words victory, moving forward, pushing out the enemy, to use those and not to use the words retreat or the enemy broke through our defenses. On top of that, the propaganda of the Kiev regime in these instances quickly deems cities it's lost as being ones without any strategic importance or heavily subsidized. Examples are Karakhova, Korahovskoye, Terezk, Pokrovsk, and the remainder of the Donbas that remains in the Ukrainian Armed Forces' control. And yet, the West continues to supply the Kiev regime with military equipment, including military artillery systems, UAVs, and tanks, including to ensure that Western defense companies can make a quick penny and to use up their outdated or old military equipment. And the Kiev junta is also remembering to line its pockets. The Pentagon recently conducted an audit according to which $2.1 billion sent to Ukraine between January and to December 2022, that's the money that was audited. And it was found out that $1.1 billion were unaccounted for, undocumented. It's unclear how we can check those payments. As for the corruption that goes hand in hand with the deliveries of military equipment to Ukraine, is something that journalists will look into later. And yet, already Washington and its allies are realizing that the Zelensky regime's problem lies not in the fact that it doesn't have enough weapons or ammunition. The main reason for the Ukrainian forces falling back on the front is the fact that the people no longer believe the ex-actor, which lost all legitimacy back in May. Zelensky campaigned using slogans about peace with Russia, equal rights for Russian speakers, protecting Orthodox Christianity. That's why people voted for him. However, subsequently, in order to please Western geopolitical interests, he chose the opposite path, turning his country into a pawn in the game against Russia, in the hope that with the US's help, Ukraine can become a queen on the chessboard. This is a treacherous pass, treacherous vis-à-vis the Ukrainian people. And so Zelensky sold fertile land and strategic companies to Western corporations for a pittance. This process is ongoing. As we found out from the secret annex to the so-called Zelensky peace plan, Ukraine is ready to provide to the U.S. the use of strategic resources in Ukraine, uranium, titanium, lithium, and graphite. These annexes are probably secret because, according to Article 13 of the Ukrainian Constitution, the Ukrainian subsoil does not belong to the government. It belongs to the people of Ukraine. And giving away these resources to foreign companies would require a referendum as a bare minimum. I'd like to remind you that the U.S. has already been eyeing up these deposits. Senator Lindsey Graham suggested that the U.S. could provide assistance to Kyiv in exchange for access to minerals, which he valued at $10 to $12 trillion. Selling off all of Ukraine's assets is something other sponsors of the Kyiv regime are insisting on. A European Council decision on giving out loans against frozen Russian assets, in that document there's a condition on the transfer to Brussels of the Ukrainian military-industrial complex assets. Recognizing that the current Ukrainian leader is acting in the best traditions of thieves, traitors, and against the people, hetmans, realizing that Ukrainians are turning away from Zelensky en masse. As a result, the Ukrainian army is experiencing a catastrophic lack of servicemen, and there are no more volunteers turning up at the draft offices. In order to solve this problem, the regime is using all sorts of tricks, inventing more and more sophisticated methods to get their hands on recruits. In order to plug holes in their front lines, young men are not only being grabbed in the streets, in public transport, in small cities. In fact, the draft officers are lying in wait for them at concerts and restaurants in Kyiv, places where young men used to be able to go without fearing being snatched by the draft office, and then a few days later, after some perfunctory training, ending up on the front lines. The hunt for men is very harsh. It is not regulated by any laws. According to information that's made it online, in Ukraine, as part of the forced mobilization, over 100 men have died at the hands of these draft officer polizeis. No one's been detained, no one's been punished, and the information about these incidents has been hushed up. And yet, still, there is not enough cannon fodder on the front. At the behest of Kyiv's backers, increasingly we're hearing calls to lower the draft age to 18 to 21 years old. In this context, many are hiding at home, dodging the draft, fleeing the country. Online, there are many videos showing Ukrainian men who've managed to cross the border congratulating themselves on fleeing what they call Zelensky's concentration camp. Quite a few of them opt to go to Russia. Between February of 2022 and 2023, in that period alone, 5.3 million Ukrainian refugees arrived in the Russian Federation. Now there are many more on our soil. And yet Zelensky and his posse are incensed that those who've moved to the West, that these Ukrainians, when they encounter everyday problems, humiliation and discrimination based on the language they speak, not only decide to move to Russia, but they're actually moving to the very regions which joined our country following the referendums in the fall of 2022, and they're doing this en masse. Ukrainian men who haven't managed to flee, who are being sent to the front line forcibly, they've decided to surrender right away or to desert. According to the data from the Public Prosecutor's Office of the Ukraine, in the first 8 months of 2024, almost 30,000 cases were opened following incidents of soldiers going AWOL. Back in 2022, there were only 6,500 such cases. According to experts, in actual fact, the number of deserters runs into the hundreds of thousands, between 100,000 and 170,000. All of Ukraine is heatedly discussing what's happening, this free-for-all surrounding the mobilization process. And it is only Kyiv's Western sponsors who are trying to turn a blind eye to this fatal trend, trying to convince the head of the Kyiv regime to continue sending these poor souls to the front. Ukrainian soldiers who we've taken prisoner have said that in order to avoid demotivated Ukrainian recruits from fleeing right away, in the rear guard, there are well-motivated nationalists and neo-Nazis who are basically anti-retreat forces, shooting them in the back if they try to flee. Another way of keeping up the fighting spirits in the Ukrainian army is pumping the army full of foreign mercenaries. Since we began the special military operation, at least 15,000 mercenaries from over 100 countries have arrived in Ukraine. Most of them have been liquidated, but private military companies from Poland and the US are trying to enlist more, trying to entice people to send their servicemen to Ukraine as cannon fodder. Specifically, the following private military companies are actively involved: Academy Quebec Dacos Benefits, Dean Corporation, Forward Observation Group, Hyperion Services, Sign of Liberty International, and the Polish private military companies ASBS Otago and European Security Academy. It is mercenaries and nationalists who stand behind the most notorious, the most chilling crimes and violations of international humanitarian law, including those committed by bandits and marauders when they invaded the Kursk region. We have incontrovertible evidence of the most serious crimes being committed by the Kiev regime vis-a-vis the civilians and civilian infrastructure in Russian cities. This is something we convincingly demonstrated at the Aria Formula meeting last week. The fact that Ukrainian soldiers shot at civilians in the Kursk region who were fleeing is something that even American journalists had to recognize just a few days ago. Madam President, without a doubt, none of the truth I've just told you will be repeated by Western colleagues today, just like we won't hear any comments from them regarding the countless violations by the Zelensky regime of the Convention on Certain Conventional Weapons. They have been deliberately mining, Ukrainian units have been deliberately mining road shoulders, bridges, and territories surrounding residential buildings, hospitals, and educational institutions. They've been using the civilian population, mining them with anti-personnel mines called PETL, other traps, and mining the bodies of fallen civilians and servicemen. For instance, just a few days ago, a video appeared online in which a Ukrainian army soldier is stuffing explosives into a child's toy, saying that this toy will be sent to the Kursk region. Its hackneyed narrative is repeated by the West, and that's easier than assessing the facts which show that the Ukrainian armed forces have been systematically using against the Russian armed forces and civilians toxic chemicals, which are scheduled in the Convention on Chemical Weapons, BZ, and chloropicrin as well. They've been using other agents, including riot control agents. These facts are either hushed up or, as per the West's tradition, they're trying to accuse the Russian Federation of using these chemicals. On the 21st of October, the representative of Slovenia tried to lay the blame on Russia, the blame for using chemical substances, toxic substances, in the same river. He forgot that back on the 13th of September, in this very chamber, we warned against the potential release of toxic chemicals in the following rivers, the Seine and the Desna. And this could be done by a military industrial complex company, Ukrainian one, in the Sumy region. Madam President, by way of conclusion, I recommend that our Western colleagues muster up their courage and recognize that the course they've chosen, fighting Russia using Ukrainian hands, is unjustified. The hopes of inflicting strategic defeat on our country and forecasts about the inevitable crash of our economy have not come to pass, no matter how much the UK representative tried to convince us of the opposite yesterday. The facts are very stubborn, and they show that the short-sighted policies pursued by Washington, London, and Brussels, the economic and energy crisis have hit Western countries and their citizens the hardest, whereas the Russian Federation managed to withstand thousands of sanctions. Our economy is growing. Last year, it grew roughly 3.5%. This year, economic growth is estimated at 4%, 3.9%. And yet the Eurozone economy is teetering on the brink of recession. We've heard that the world's Germany's biggest company, Volkswagen, plans to close at least three plants to lay off tens of thousands of staff and to enact a pay cut to the tune of 18% on the remainder of its staff. Siemens, in the meantime, said that investing in Germany is pointless and the company will now only invest in broadening its capacity abroad. Attempts to isolate our country were proven to be in vain last week, in Kazan, we held the BRICS summit attended by leaders from 36 countries and six international organizations. They are the drivers of a process for finding just, sustainable and lasting peace to the Ukrainian crisis based on respect for the UN Charter in full, not just the bits about territorial integrity. They also call for the resolution of its root causes, coming up with lasting and equal security formula, which take into account the interests of all global players. This is a serious approach. It's not just some attempt to impose ultimatums on Russia, something that's divorced from reality. I'd like to warn you that we cannot have a repeat of the scenario with the Minsk agreement. We can't simply freeze the front so that the Zelensky regime can lick its wounds, just like we won't have Ukraine in NATO in any form. Our special military operation aims at demilitarization and denazification in Ukraine. All of the objectives remain in force. They're unchanged. What is changing, and precipitously so, is the size of the territory under the control of the Kiev regime. I suggest those cheering on their Ukrainian sidekicks to remember this fact and to think not about the Zelensky posse, but rather about the interests of the Ukrainian people. Their long-term interests lie in peace and good neighborly relations with the Russian Federation. So far, our Western colleagues aren't managing to do so very well. I thank you.
Merci. Je passe la parole.
Thank you.